Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cries the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, pray for guidance. We'll be right back.
my freaky darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets After Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you are on the right night. But please check out our other After Midnight shows. Join Jeremy Thursday morning as he brings you the Headliner's Ball. Break on through with Pam on Friday. Saturday, join Aphasiana and Babla as they teach you the fine art of being part sinner, part saint. And every other Sunday, join Robert M. as he brings you the solace of shadows. These shows are designed to shoot and color outside the lines with rich, raw emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought through pen and voice. So pull up a chair, relax, and open your minds. I'm Rex, my co-host Pam Ray, and I can't wait to get into and read your words. Good evening, Pam.
Good evening, Rex. How's it going?
All right.
Awesome, awesome. Very cool, very cool. What have you been up to today? Anything exciting?
Mulching a couple of beds.
The what?
Mulching a couple of beds.
Oh, nice. Preparing for planting in the spring, huh?
No, just mulching that which is already there. So they've got some cover. After all, I've got millions of leaves all over the place.
Nice, nice. Well, yeah, and the thing is that it, actually that's really good for the ground. And, you know, a lot of people rake their leaves up and don't use them. Like, but they can be very useful for, you know, adding nutrients into the ground.
Yeah, plus they rot and create dirt, so might as well use them.
Absolutely, absolutely, very true. Very true. Yeah. Well, good, good. Sounds like a nice busy day. I had a nice busy day too. Went and got laundry done, ran errands, made pork steaks for dinner and black bean and corn salad. And, yeah, it was all really good stuff. And the weather wasn't too bad either. But, I'm just kind of looking. I'm looking at our topic board because I'm trying to figure out if something is supposed to be a carryover or if we already read it, and I can't remember. A good busy day today. That's always nice to have. And we got a great lineup of poetry tonight.
Cool.
Yes. Poetry inspired. I got a couple of carryovers. Then we delve into the poetry inspired by quotes from Randall Jarrell.
All right.
Yeah. So good stuff. Good stuff for sure. And All right. Well, with that being said. Do you remember if we read this one last week, Ice to Hold into V?
Because
don't think we did. Oh,
yes,
we did.
I remember because of that one word, because I have glimmers, some tear.
Ah, okay. Well, then let me take that down. I know for sure, okay. All right, well, let's try this next one. How about, and I'm sure we didn't read this one because I think it was a late edition after after the show started. Man, I should have asked you this stuff earlier. I wasn't confused until like the last 5 seconds of the song, though. Torquemada by Arcana O'More?
Torquemada, no.
Okay, Torquemada. Well, then we will put that up first, and we do have a SoundCloud for that. So here we go.
Amid inquisitions of absent emotion, I kneel in prayers of religious devotion, hands clasped tightly around my cross, with faith I endorse the mortal loss. I know God seals my work with approval, thrusting protests for hell's removal, as they plead for mercy. From all my zeal, I impatiently force their bodies to feel. Confess, I cry, with persuasive conviction, driven by passionate, pious addiction. Join the masses of those truly chosen. Obedience shall thaw your faith that's frozen, frozen, frozen. Confess your sin of disbelief as I pour forth rivers of painful grief. I'll stretch you till your joints go pop, then watch you fail to stand and drop. Confess to me now before it's too late. I'll grant your release with swifter fate. As I twist the rack and watch you cry, confess to me quickly before you die. I'll tether your struggles to the nearest post, then set you alight to burn like toast, watching flesh blister in charred submission as I pursue my mission of avid contrition. Feel the flames that kiss your feet. Know your beliefs will taste defeat. Whoever you pray to has left you to suffer. My deity is stronger than any other. I smell the scent of your roasting flesh, cleansing your spirit as you writhe and thresh. Your screams will be heard high up in heaven. I'll free your soul of the devil's possession. Confess and subjugate yourself to me. Watch through eyes my truth to see. Confess, midst your screaming pain. I've saved so many from those I've slain. I'll purge you of your blaspheming ways that scream from lips in a tortured blaze. You'll never be the same after my embrace. Watch the smile etched upon my face. I feel no mercy, for I enjoy this torture, stretching you taller from being shorter. Confess, I ask you this one last time, as I condemn you to agony for your crime. I am God's envoy, I'll show you the way. If you refute his truth, I'll make you pay. Your misery weeps from tears of sorrow. confess today, avoid torment tomorrow. In screams I hear his tender forgiveness. Once you admit you bear false witness, I feel no contrition. It feeds my hate toward divine hunger. I need to say.
Great read there, Arcana. Thank you very much for SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. All right, Pam, what do you think?
Oh, my gosh, that was awesome. What a performance. I see that he said at the top of his poem, he gave a thank you. With thanks to my talented friend Theodore Samalotis for allowing me to remix his track Endomorphism. And, man, that picture that he put with it, this is an epic dark rite. Love the performance, the first-person narrative. I like how he really gets into the character. It really sends chills up and down my spine because he gets that much into the mindset of a torturer who claims to speak for a higher power, who claims to speak on behalf of God. It very much reminds me of the witch trials or the werewolf trials, and how oftentimes people would falsely confess to things, to being a witch or being a werewolf, just based on the torment, the torture they were getting. It was easier to confess falsely rather than continue to be tortured. I really liked this all the way through. But I particularly like, I feel no mercy, for I enjoy this torture, stretching you taller from being shorter. The idea of being on that stretching rack. I am God's envoy. I'll show you the way. If you refute his truth, I'll make you pay. Your misery weeps from tears of sorrow. Confess today. Avoid torment tomorrow. Those lines really speak strongly, as I was saying, on the idea of that it was easier to give a false confession than to deal with the torment. Excellent, right, and very well done.
Nice. Well, I like the this was deep and dark, and it does walk into the note of the man himself, Tomás de Torquemada. He was a friar who was pointed the Grand Inquisitor of Spain, 1480 or so, by the Pope. And it was that designation of ensuring that the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church was adhered to. So a lot of its 2,000 victims were of Jewish and Muslim faith, because they had driven out a lot, but they wanted to, those who had converted, he went in and actually tortured those people. Quite.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I remember, let me see, was it in History of the World, Part 1, Mel Brooks did a movie. Part of it included Torquemada, and he did a dance number, well, a song and dance number, The Inquisition, do-do-do-do-do-do, The Inquisition. And then at the back end of things, he had, he had a bunch of Jews hanging on the wall, and they said, let's face it, you can't talk them out of anything, because that's where the voice
wow.
comes from. Talk them out of and talk them out of. No, didn't work. And he was a religious zealot at that point in time. And according to, I think, history, if it wasn't for what he did back then, a number of things wouldn't have happened. Well, the Inquisition, for one thing, and Columbus sailing for the new shores, that which they thought was out there, the Americas. So he had his hand in a lot of things way back when, and he lived to a ripe old age of 78, despite everything that he did in the name of Catholic orthodoxy in regards to what is and what isn't allowable. And yeah, everything Arkan has gotten here is truth to the man himself. And he had no compunction, no fears, and he didn't regret anything because it was all accounted for in the name of God, so to speak. So I like this piece.
Yeah, me too. And I already liked it in the first place, but I liked it even more after learning that from you. You know, and just when I think I know all the evil there is to know, more comes along. And if that wasn't just horrifying enough to torment people and to speak falsely on behalf of God, but to do it while singing, oh, my goodness.
He didn't sing. Mel Brooks took it with a song and dance number in the movie. Mel Brooks is making light of it. Mel Brooks is Jewish, and the victims were largely Jewish. So he took the extreme angle of what Torquemada did and put it up with a twisted angle to to what was behind the man himself, as well as the religion and the times.
Still horrifyingly evil guy, but I'm so glad I got to learn something new tonight. Very cool. Book.
Torquemada is largely ignored as part of the history of things.
Yeah, well, that's a shame. That's a shame. People should know more about things like this. But before we go on to the next poem, I do want to welcome Robert to the show, and I figure if he got a chance to read or to hear that poem, he'd probably like to comment on it. So welcome, Robert. Glad you could join us.
Hello. I got to read through it, and it kind of reminded me also of the end of the movie Braveheart, when he was like, you know, hey, just confess your sins and it'll be all over. Just confess your sins and it'll be all over. And he's like, nah, bro, I ain't going to do that. Freedom. So, well, it didn't go exactly like that, but similar enough. But, you know, this kind of really reflects on the barbaric and archaic institutions of old that are still actually somewhat prevalent in the world, and what you would refer to as underdeveloped countries. And there's still these torture mechanisms. There's all kinds of means of terrible, terrible ways to instill fear and amass the evil upon the human race. And he did a good job in touching on that. And history lessons with Rex are always nice. So, yeah, you always learn something new. So, yeah, I as always, Arkana does a great job, whether he's rhyme or free verse or whatever he does to tell his story, he does it well. So I'll give him kudos on that and for giving us some history on top of everything. So, yeah.
Nice. I like that thought with the end of Braveheart. That was a great call there. That would have been part of the angle of confession. Confess your souls, it'll be over quickly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's never over quickly for that being done, Tim.
Yep. All right. Well, up next we have The Philosopher by Dammit Dave. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
The Philosopher by Dammit Dave. In my youth, I fancied myself a philosopher, my thirst for knowledge only matched by my hunger for love and affection. It was a time when I questioned everything but knew nothing. Existence then was an eternity, and death was a stranger, and though life had its rules, I was quite eager to break them, or at least bend them a little. In those days, my dreams were as vast as the Montana sky, and I dared to reach for them again and again, lucky enough to reach a few, and stubborn enough to keep grasping at the fruits that hung too high upon the tree. But youth is a callow child, slain by the sword of maturity, and the blade of adulthood is sharp and double-edged. It has a way of slicing through dreams, leaving them in pieces upon the cold, hard ground of reality. Philosophy turns to cynicism, love transforms to distrust, and the flower of faith wilts upon its fragile stem. The sunshine of hope is slowly blocked out, and the death stands lurking in shadow. The young optimist dons the spectacles of disenchantment, and the world fades from technicolor to dreary shades of gray. End poem. All right, Pam, what do you think?
Well, first of all, great read there, Rex. I always enjoy poetry by Dammit Dave, and he wrote to the prompt, "When you're young, you try to be methodical and philosophical, but reality keeps breaking in." And I like how this has that bittersweet feel to it, that idea of losing that hope, of youth. Wonderful, wonderful free verse. I really like, "In those days, my dreams were as vast as a Montana sky, and I dared to reach for them again and again, lucky enough to reach a few and stubborn enough to keep grasping at the fruit that hung too high upon the tree." And then where it goes on to the poet says, "Philosophy turns to cynicism, love transforms to distrust, and the flower of faith wilts upon its fragile stem." I thought those were amazing lines because, to me, they're ones that I think many people can relate to, because it is that idea of how circumstances view the way we see the world, see ourselves, and even, see other people. Excellent write and very well done.
Nice. Thank you very much, Pam. And Robert, how about you?
Well, I have to say that this is probably one of my favorites from Dammit Dave, because it seems like he kind of went into the zone like a whole different avenue and just took this and ran with it. I'm used to his poems rhyming. I haven't seen much free verse, or maybe I wasn't paying attention. That's also possible. But I also like the one that Pam pointed out, but where it says philosophy turns to cynicism, love transforms to distrust, because it shows the transformation, like the metamorphosis from young and dumb to, old and grumpy, or whatever you want to call it, or you're not even old, but, just like you end up turning more bitter over time. The fireworks don't shine like they used to, none of that stuff. Like, everything becomes a little more dull. And he shows that, I like this part, "But youth is a callow child slain by the sword of maturity, and the blade of adulthood is sharp and double-edged." So with experience and with gaining knowledge, you tend to be less gleeful, and you start worrying a whole lot more. So I think you really did a great job in capturing the quote. This is a quote I was going to try to write to you, but my muse is playing hard to get. So I'm glad he did, because this was a fantastic poem.
Great comment, Robert. Thank you. And you're right, this does walk that way. And the fact that he didn't go, he went with free verse instead of rhyming, gave him the opportunity, or allowed him to actually dig a little deeper into that thought itself. Because with the rigors of rhyming, sometimes you get lost with what you're trying to put out. But this way, he can feel the flow and let it roll, which he did with. I like that opening stanza. It was nice. And that it was a time when I questioned everything but knew nothing. That kind of hits on the note of who and what it was at that point in time, because usually it was a time when we question everything and we feel that we know everything in the moment. That youthful glee of, yeah, I know more than my father did or my mother, yet somewhere down the line we wake up to the fact that we really know nothing anyway. But the transition to this existence hits on that note, because, yeah, he hits on that. Existence then was an eternity, and death was a stranger. And though life had its rules, I was quite eager to break them, or at least bend them a little. There is that note of, yeah, we always no, those rules aren't meant for us. So we bend them a little or outright break them, and then we move into that new realm of mid-20s to late-20s where things start to make a little bit more sense because you're settling into who and what you are and the world as a whole. And that youth as a cattle child is a great look at that, and the adulthood is sharp and double-edged because you don't really, even though your parents try to teach you, you don't really take that to heart until you're actually out in the world realizing, yeah, things aren't as easy as we pertain them to be. And that thought of losing that childhood innocence really does bite at us in the long run. And if we're not careful, as he points out, the world fades from technicolor into dreary shades of gray. So not in the idea of you got to keep that little bit of child, that childhood glee within you, or that child within you, so that the world itself doesn't crush you in the long run. But here, it kind of hits on that note of being crushed at the end. So great piece there, Dave. Thank you very much.
Well said there, Rex. And I would like to welcome Laurent to the show. Welcome, Laurent. Glad you could join us.
Thank you, thank you. It was a great quote. I'm sorry I'm late because I was trying to finish my poem for tonight, and I'm late doing so, but here I am.
Excellent.
Oh, very
good evening.
Did you get a chance to read Damn It Dave's poem or to hear it?
I didn't hear it, but I read it, and I don't know whether to be impressed by the piece or completely sad with the fact that this poem mirrors so well my take on life and my current state of mind. That those lines, philosophy turns to cynicism, love transforms to distrust, and the flower of faith wilts upon its fragile stem. The sunshine of hope is slowly blocked out, and the death stands lurking in shadow. And, you know, you feel those things running through you, but you push them away time after time, but damn, things keep coming back. He really did a great job with his piece. I got to admire it.
Excellent.
Oh,
nice. Well, all right, Pam, where do you want to go?
Let's see. Well, let me just finish my sentence that I'm going to put in Late Night Poet since I was almost done with it anyways. There we go. And I couldn't resist.
Oh, nice, Robin.
All right. Well, Laurent, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to put your poem up, and because I know a lot of times you can't stay up real late, but of course, as long as you can join us, you know, after you read is absolutely fabulous with us. So go ahead and give
thank
that
you.
A read for us.
I will do my best, and thank you very much for your consideration. Okay. I was fascinated by the quote, by the prompt about, you know, owning the place, so to speak. And this is the result. It's called Karma Fail. Odile carried chaos in her eyes, storms forming on her lips. Lashing tongue brought the flame and fury to bear on objects of her scorn. Inanimate suffered less than the living and breathing souls who bore her displeasure. Nonetheless, wood shows its scars, proof of a physical revulsion reaction. Backhanding objets d'art off the shelves where they might lay for hours while she stared at them, her disgust coalescing into a kind of forgiveness made by man, after all, imperfect. Her apartment was a Gordian knot of disorganization and clutter, piles of things on things teetering sideways, constantly threatening a tidal wave of arcane impulse purchases for which she had no room. Nor had she room for people, resenting the inevitable conflict normal social discourse generated. Odile oozed disapproval from every pore, never shy in displaying it. This paragon of discontent passed last Thursday, run over by her own hard-to-start car, after she kicked its tires several times and stalked off down the road, choosing to walk the short distance to market. Fate understands gravity and sloped driveways. Manual transmission left in neutral, plus shock from kicking, equals an inch forward, a second, a quicker third, and at last, rolling faster, the inanimate accomplishes the goal of the animate. Silent death has tapped her shoulder, given her a ride on a black train, delivering her to the marketplace of infernal choices, where Odile is involuntarily employed as a customer service representative. Scouted by the devil, selected number one in the draft as a switch-hitting tool of torment. Ironically and eternally, a job she enjoys. No justice. Karma fail. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. Thank you very much. And Robert, why don't we start with you? What'd you think?
Well, I thought, it was a great read and also a great write. I appreciate the irony in it. And it did have me smiling from the middle to the end because I saw where it was picking up at. And I think the paragon of discontent was actually an awesome phrase. I don't know. I always like the word paragon, and hardly anybody uses it. And so you did a great job with it there. But the moral of the story is you think, you know, she's getting her just desserts and she's headed to hell, but nope, she's still doing all right. So I really enjoyed the humor and the depth of the piece because it was like a really intricate story. Like, you know, you told it very well. And I there's words in here obviously I never heard, like where you said backhanding objects, the art of shells. I didn't know what that was, but it was sounded really nice.
French.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but anyways, I enjoyed this piece from start to finish, and I really enjoyed the ending because karma is, I guess, not perfect either. So there you have it. Right. Thanks for that, Laurent.
Great comment. Thank you, Robert.
I agree. That was a great comment, Robert. Thank you. Pam, you're up.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one. I thought it was very clever, wonderful dark humor. As Robert says, it's got irony to it, which works so well. And I do like that ending where it turns out that, karma failed. This was a wonderful takeoff of your chosen prompt. I'm glad you were inspired. And I like how it shows us at first with the idea of how chaotic her living life was and how little she cared for people, for herself, for anything or anyone. I thought her apartment was a Gordian knot of disorganization and clutter. Was one of the perfect ways to describe an extremely messy apartment, an extremely messy life. And that's one thing I like is that the apartment represents basically what her life is. Nor had she room for people, resenting the inevitable conflict normal social discourse generated. Oodle ooze disapproval from every pore, never shy in displaying it. Like I said, a wonderful dark right. It's always fun to see a twist, like, because you always expect something like this for karma to work in the end, but the twist that it didn't just really worked well. So very cool. Very cool. Excellent right.
Thank you, Sam.
I'll agree. Definitely, I enjoyed the humor at the back end of this because it was twisted and it held itself with sardonic fun. that you got two standards near the end that walks real easy. The Paragon of Discontent passed last Thursday, run over by her own hard-to-start car, and she kicked its tires several times and stalked off down the road, choosing to walk the short distance to market. Fate understands gravity, and sloped driveways, manual transmission, left and neutral, plus shock from kicking equals an inch forward, a second, a quicker third, at last rolling faster the inanimate, accomplishes the goal of the animus. I thought that because you rolled in the manual transmission and then you offer up the gears as the seconds ticking off and then the final roll, the freedom in going forth. And the fact that the devil actually gets someone whom he truly wants and will enjoy the work kind of offers up that note of pleasure within his eyes, as well as the pleasure she's going to get out of the job because she's already built for it. So that's a nice twist of ending.
Yeah, well, she owns the place now.
Yes, the twist in that might be she'll work her way up and toss the devil out, so he might actually want to look over his shoulder.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, Pam, what do you got next?
All right. Up next, we have Boots Stomp by Grant G. And Robert, will you give that a read for us, please?
I will try. Okay, Boots Stomp. Boots Stomp, rushing up concrete stairs. It's cold outside. Only the brave dare. Door knocks. Boom, boom, boom. Police and soldiers. Aggression stares. Guns, shields, batons show their intent. One, two, three. Door flies open. Message sent. Screaming, shouting, guns, batons waved. A young man and a woman dragged away. Neighbors shout, waving their fist. Sympathizers, they hate these Brits. Police vans drive away. Soldiers patrol. Aggression stays. To internment, these young folks go. For singing songs, only rebels know. End poem.
Great read, Robert. Thank you very much. And Levant, why don't we start with you, please?
Certainly. But does anyone know what prompt number one was?
That would be
it
a great
was...
revolutionist started the war on great revolutionists.
I'm sorry, please say that again.
A great revolution is hardest of all on the great revolutionists.
Yeah, to those that have to suffer first. At first, boots stomp, rushing up concrete stairs. It's cold outside, only the brave dare. Door knocks, boom, 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 police and soldiers. Aggression stares. Kind of put me in mind of World War II initially, but it showed a more modern and more a more contemporary message in its right. The neighbors shout, waving their fists. Sympathizers, they hate these Brits. It speaks of occupation by the British Empire and the oppressed doing their best to rebel and then having to serve penance for the rebellion, internment, which generates the songs that only rebels know, because only by being a rebel will you, I think, feel the emotions and be inspired to language that can become quite famous and long-lasting. Many revolutionaries have uttered immortal words to this day. So, yeah, I like this piece a lot.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Laurent. And Pam, what about you?
Yeah, I thought this had, as always, short, impactful lines, which worked especially well with the imagery that he wanted to portray, the idea of, you know, a police-occupied state, or, you know, the idea of police violence or, you know, violence against the common people. You know, and you could just, you know, you can just hear the noise of this poem, you know, as he gets into lines like screaming, shouting, guns, batons, wave, a young man and woman dragged away, neighbors shout, waving their fists. I mean, it really just packs an emotional punch with the imagery that he offers. And I really liked the imagery all the way through and the strength in the lines. I really particularly like near the end where he says, soldiers patrol, aggression stays, to internment, these young folk go for singing songs only rebels know. And it just goes to show you that throughout history and even nowadays there are places where if you sing the wrong song, if you read the wrong book, you know, recite the wrong poem, you can get, in a lot of trouble. That's not the phrase I wanted to use, but that's the only one that comes to my mind. But basically, it's the idea that there is, in this particular scene here, there is no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of thought. So excellent write and very well done.
Well said, Pam. Thank you very much. And Robert, how about you? What did you think?
Well, it was very impactful to me because I've experienced a similar situation in my life. So the police often lived in the area almost practically where I was at. So there was always doors being kicked in and people being drug around and things like that. So I can understand the fear and the discomfort and the overall chaos that ensues when the doors are being knocked on and busted open and things like that. And the message that at the end there, like how Pam mentioned, it says police vans drive away, soldiers patrol, aggression stays. So even when their presence is not there, their aggression, the result of their visit or even just the results of the surrounding environment is still there. So there is no rest. There's no respite from it. It's just all chaos. And in that time period or whichever situation they were referring to. So I can understand that. And it is a terrible, terrible thing. It hit me pretty good. It was a good poem. Short, like Pam said, short, impactful lines. It was, it hit the nose, the nail on the head, prompt.
Excellent. Thank you, Robert. And you're right. I got this probably 70s and 80s, the Irish, the Brits looking for the IRA in Ireland. So this does walk. It hits on those notes of the scarabs rolling through the streets, the doors opening up, and all these cops and army personnel just unloading into the streets and into the buildings themselves. So I get what this is. And that back end for singing songs and the rebels know does kind of hit on that that idea of freedom, so to speak, born out of Irish culture and the need to have their land back. So well done, Grant. Thank you. All right, Pam, we're back to you.
All right, up next we have Just Like Everybody Has One by Self-Rising Mojo, and it goes like this. No slang for genitalia will be used in this poem. The language will only be coarse where necessary. The only literary reference is Bukowski, whose reported worth when he died was around $4 million, which means he really did cash in on being an asshole. I've softened my opinion of his canon and do appreciate the occasions he landed a punch to the gut of any world that used him like a mirror to look down on. I don't, however, have any respect for the way he treated women how he romanticized drunk or body functions for the sake of shock value, the way others try to do the same and call it writing, like this thing I read that shat on birds who were here first, by the way. What I really want to say is outside the glass on the window by the chair where I sit, the sky just passed a blue one like a note waiting to turn in a song. The afternoon hums for no other reason than to hear itself work. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. Why don't we start with you? What'd you think?
How can you not like a poem that begins, "No slang for genitalia will be used in this poem. The language will only be coarse where necessary." And he doesn't use any non-slang for genitalia. And the language is not really coarse at all. I like his take on Bukowski, which his net worth was around $4 million, which means he really did cash in on being an asshole. And I often wondered whether Bukowski was an asshole or not. He was just him. He had, I think, earned the right to have his opinion of the world be just the way it was. And I absolutely agree with the comment on the way he used women or treated women for shock value. But I think that's very much in keeping with his personality, with his persona, the kind of the blind striking out of men who are disappointed in life and in themselves and try to use writing as a way of self-redemption. I was amused by this guy just passed a blue one. I don't know whether passing a blue one means anything specific or whether it's a turn of the phrase or whether it's a huge airborne fart. I don't know. Because farts do have notes in a song sometimes. it's a very nice, it's a very good piece, very intelligent piece.
Wonderful comment there, Ron. Thank you very much. And Robert, how about you?
Yeah, I like the beginning too when he says the language will only be coarse when necessary, and then he mentions an asshole, which can be pretty coarse, depending, I suppose. So I don't know if he meant that, like if it was like a double meaning, but yeah. So he did use slang for an anus. So there is that. But I Bukowski, he's one of those people that I've come to know because of this site. Like I did one of my first poems in his style, and I had to go and read quite a bit of him. And yeah, he was kind of like just like that person who spoke their mind, almost like a George Carlin, the poetry type of thing, you know. And a lot of people will say that, you know, he was bitter and mean at times, but when you listen to some of his poetry, he was just very, like from what I saw of it, like he did have this other side of him, like the poem about the bird. I can't remember what it's called. But that was like a really different like type of poem than most of his other works that I've seen. So but on this poem, like addressing that, like I love his like how Lawrence is a very intelligent piece. You know, I've softened my opinion of his canon and do appreciate the occasions he landed a punch to the gut of any world that used him like a mirror to look down on. So he gives him the respect that, you know, he was a very harsh person, but sometimes that harshness was necessary to kind of like show the world what he meant, you know. And he used that, like he used his brashness as in his art. And he may not have been a fantastic person, but he was a great poet. So I appreciate this piece and on those two fronts.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Robert. All right, Pam, you got to read it. What about you?
Yes, I really like what everybody had to say. I really appreciated that Robert called Bukowski the George Carlin of poets. I thought that was one of the best observations I've heard. Now, this is an excellent write all the way through and a great take on the prompt. He had chosen the prompt, it's ugly, but is it art? And I like how he delves into the line, the realm of Bukowski, and as has been observed, the, you know, what he did, you know, that was good and what he did that was not good. Great opening lines, really attention-grabbing. No string for genitalia will be used in this poem. The language will only be coarse where necessary. You know, and I do think that is an important point with swearing. And I know there are those who will disagree with me, but I really think swearing shouldn't be overused. It should be used to really emphasize certain points. And I like how he goes through his thoughts in Bukowski and then brings us back into his world of watching nature. I thought the line, the sky just passed a blue one, like a note waiting turn, it turned in a song, really was a great way of referencing not only that Mojo's love of writing about nature, but also a reference to Bukowski's Bluebird poem, you know, and I thought that was quite clever. So excellent write and very well done.
Great comments, everybody. I thought this was humorous on the whole, and it very well walks the same realm as Bukowski, except takes a gentler note to the angle taken, the idea of how we function in the world and how we walk within those boundaries. I mean, look at Bukowski, and he took that angle of description and how we look at things and actually brought the raw angle out of it in terms that most people would find offensive, but in reality, it's just a way of looking at things instead of in the genteel terms, but in the uglier terms, and then offering up his thoughts on that realm, whether he thought that way or not. I couldn't tell you if he actually rolled that way or just used his voice to describe that which everyone and everything does, but used it in terms that that you can find a bite of humor in it and realize, hey, not everything in the world is pretty, and not everything is rose-filled. There is ugliness out there, and that thought with the George Carlin comment was great, Rob. I thought that pretty funny, too. And the back end, like a note, the sky was just past the blue one, like a note waits its turn in the song, the action hums for no other reason than to hear itself work, kind of bites at that note as well. There is sound and description and everything, and how you choose to offer it up is just a matter of voice and the words you choose. So this works itself well on that note, and as both a tribute and as well as a downturn to the voice of Bukowski. So, Mojo, well done. All right, Pam, we're coming back to you.
All right. Up next, we have The Candyman Can by Liquid Mind Forever. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
The Candyman Can by Liquid Mind Forever. Powdered and painted, red lollipop earrings dangle. Ralph Lauren perfume covers a multitude of sins within skin. Underarm deodorant burns after shaving orangutan armpits to the nub, and scum rings around the tub. I scrub, rub, dub, dub this slub from porcelain-stained tub, rub-a-dub, dub. The moon has conspired against breaching celibacy. Immediacy is the expediency outside propriety. Impiety bides alibis, but who cries as lullabies, scribble drool off the bar stool, left with cruel intent. Advent is taking two slicing in half and waiting for the bent wood to scream, being rent, time to tent. Puffed and powdered, perfume in between thighs, descrying, making alibis while faking orgasmic boredom. The king of Lent, giving up something you never wanted. Bustier and corset, push up the cup, but Renee Custer thaws while he jaws and spoils summer's new-laid petals. Crusted over from lack, beluster thrusts a must or bust. A being bereft, though theft, leaves an aftertaste of haste, the wastebasket of dreams scrapped and chafed from the nape of boredom. Remember the kingdom? I don't want relent, as bent with trees sent, I advent, time to tent. And I wait for my date on the sofa in my exhumed, fumigated frou-frou, aqua and teal tall tuft puffed at the hips like Marie Antoinette in her panier. But I am the pussycat with nine lives. Each time in the tower, all showered and flower-scented, I wilt, jilted time and time. I should learn to discern the burn earned. Spurned, I turn on the boob tube and watch Lucy reruns mashing grapes with her feet. Retreat to the fridge, unhinge a shelf of pork and beans, eats watching repeats, mean streets, grape-stained feet. Cleat demean, wean myself, clean the tub, rub-a-dub-dub, hub around grub, scrub, waiting another schlub, but he never comes. And I am left scrubbing, scum-dumb and blindsided, rear-ended, distended, extended, struck, some luck, truck stop, flouncy, mousy, lousy with hope, that mite that bites your ass while you squat pissing the missing 10 o'clock train again and again, just pain and reference stain shows up consistent as whatever we first met in the wet and wild tower, a dowager humped and lumped into a boxcar, shipped off to Dachau for another slaughterhouse, five remake. And poem. Pam, why don't you kick us off?
All right, absolutely. Well, first of all, great read there, Rex. You know, as always, Liquid Mind Forever offers up a brilliant write with amazing imagery and metaphors. I like her inner and end rhyme, the way she plays with words and phrases. I like how she has the word dangle hanging down. Let's see here. I scrub rub-a-dub-dub the schlub from porcelain-stained tub rub-a-dub-dub. The moon has conspired against breaching celibacy immediacy in this expediency outside, propriety, impiety bides, alibis, the who cries. I like how it speaks on covering up a multitude of sins. It's the idea that if you look pretty, you smell pretty, you have the right money and you rub the right palms, you can get away with almost anything. I like the mention of Marie Antoinette. I thought that was clever, and in fact, it made you think that the idea of someone like, you know, like it makes you think about the life of Marie Antoinette and how she went from the absolute heights of power to being torn down by the people. And this is powerful all the way through, but it really hits home with that ending, with shipped off to Dachau for another Slaughterhouse 5 remake. That idea that you can only make the ugliness of life beautiful for so long. A lot of clever takes here. I really also like, I should learn to discern the burn urns, spurned, I turn on the boob tube and watch Lucy reruns mashing grapes with her feet. I thought it was really clever the way she fit in watching Lucy reruns and the idea, and to me that represents the idea of hiding from the problems of the world by turning off any connection to it and indulging in mindless entertainment. I think the use of the word boob tube was just spot on, because one, it means television, and two, it boob can mean stupid. And I like how this takes a look at the idea that you can ignore the problems and you can act like they're not there, but eventually you're going to get dragged off in that box car along with all the other prisoners. So powerful write and very well done.
Great comment there, Pam. Thank you very much. And Robert, how about you?
Well, I always have a hard time deciphering Liquid's pieces. My brain just can't wrap around them. But from what I can tell is that I don't know if it's speaking of a person who is in depression, but who's playing the part to seem like they're not. That's what it seems like to me, because they're talking about the raw grittiness of it, you know, sitting there in the tub, and not many people know or understand, but many people who have depression tend to not bathe as much, and so maybe finally she decided that she felt good enough to do so, you know, and that's why there's the ring around the tub and of all the scum and all that stuff. And she's powdering herself up and trying to look nice to maybe take part of being human again, at least for a little while. And it says the moon has conspired against preaching celibacy. Immediacy is the expediency outside propriety. Impiety buys alibis, but who cries as lullabies scribble drool off the bar stool, left with cruel intent? You know, so to me it seems like as if this person finally got up the guts to get up and take a shower, go out and go to the bar and try and meet somebody maybe. I don't know. That's the thing that I see out of it. And at the end, when she says, like what Pam mentioned, where is it at? Retreat to the fridge, unhinge a shelf of pork and beans, eat watching repeats, mean streets, grape-stained feet, cleats to mean myself. So, you know, like she's taking now she's back at home and back in her comfort zone and lulling herself back into her sorrow, but trying to distract herself. That's what I get out of it anyway, so I don't know. But I if that's the case, then, you know, and if I hit the nail on the head, hey, so be it. But that's what I got out of it.
Excellent. Thank you, Robert. And Laurent, how about you?
Lord, what hasn't this woman written that I don't admire? I agree with Robert a little bit. Sometimes her poetry takes several rereadings and decipherings, not because they're obtuse or poorly written or the emotions and message poorly delivered, but because she calls in so much imagery that leads to very pertinent information, which helps understand the piece. She lists three prompts: the revolutionary, a poet is a man who manages in a lifetime of standing out in thunderstorms to be struck by lightning 5 or 6 times, no luck, in other words, or incredible luck, if that's what you're trying to do. But more than anything, the blind date that has stood you up your life. She's taking that blind date, making it the crux of the story in terms of the form the message is delivered in. But to me, that message in the last two lines, shipped off to Dachau for another Slaughterhouse-Five remake. I mean, if I remember correctly, Slaughterhouse-Five was in main part about the firebombing of Dresden, and how you bring that into this poem only makes sense if you look carefully. A poet is a man who manages in a lifetime of standing out in thunderstorms, etc. And this poor woman has been. This is not the first time that she has been stood up. I'm certain of that. But she does her best to become presentable. Got to admire the language in this. It's almost transcendent in some ways. The way she dances between normal prose and little bursts of rhyme that fit perfectly, even in nonsense things like, I scrub rub-a-dub-dub this schlub from porcelain-stained tub, rub-a-dub-dub. Somehow that fits. It speaks to the boredom that she mentions a little later, making alibis while faking orgasmic boredom, the kingdom of Lent, giving up something you never wanted, a found to be very, very clever. She has pushed herself to become attractive, but to absolutely no good purpose, because she's left eating and putting the pain aside and enduring life, being hit by thunderstorms. What else can you say about a piece like this except that it's excellent?
And that was a great comment. I walk within kind of where you were going there, Ron. That opening stanza kind of hits on the ideal of youth itself. Pattern painted red along the clock earrings, Ralph Lauren perfume covers a multitude of sins within skin. That hits on a touch of age rolling in. Underarm deodorant burns after shaving, orangutan armpits to the nub, and scum rings around the tub. A scrub rubber dub like the schlub from porcelain stained tub, rubber dub dub. Kind of hits at that notion of tending to oneself. And then she hits on the back of the note of the moon is conspired against breaching celibacy. So time to tense, time to find that that other scent to fill the void. The faking orgasm and boredom, again, that sort of length, giving up something you never wanted. The idea of going out for that, yes, she gets stood up, and then still time to tent, looking for that. And then it's later on, she gets on the back end of even older court with the idea of, the back end of this, shipped off to Dachau for another Slaughterhouse 5 remake. That does hit on what you thought there for Burning of Dresden, but also it kind of hits on the idea of as you get older, you're not looked upon the same, and it kind of sucks in the moment that a wet and wild tower, a dowager humped and lumped into a boxcar, all of a sudden the woman is thought of as less than desirable, and that Slaughterhouse 5 remake kind of hits on the notion of being left out in the rain or just shipped off to a place where you aren't that you don't show that much availability anymore because you're older. So the twist here being it kind of sucks getting older as a woman, as everything seems to point that way, and the life sucks going that route. And most guys look for younger, just like some women getting up in age, they look for younger too. So the bite, getting older sucks. All right, Cam, we're coming your way.
All right, great observations there, everyone. And up next, we have A Christmas Gift by S. Sharp. And Lawrence, will you go ahead and give that a read first, please?
Yes, ma'am. I will just press add comment. Think myself lucky for not being halfway through a long one when I have to leave it. Okay. A Christmas Gift, S. Sharp. He stumbled along Sixth Avenue, blue jeans blackened and torn by life's jagged edges. Hunger popped from his face. Sunken cheeks hidden by a straggly, dirty, gray beard. Bony chest and arms wrapped in rags, bounded effortlessly into and out of dumpsters behind the mini mall. The morning freeze held me bundled in coat and scarf, but he seemed oblivious to its presence. He jumped out of a container, our eyes locked, but soon he vaulted himself into another behind tattered books. Stopped, I watched as he held book after book in his hands. Slowly, I approached, reaching into my pocket, the spirit of the season, offering him a $20 bill. From within the trash receptacle, he rested his arms on its edge with a book in each hand. He said, "I'm okay. Life and I have learned to get along. I find food when I need it and try to take just my fair share." He seemed at peace. I stood with the $20 still outstretched in my hand. I'm looking for nourishment of the mind right now. He held up a worn copy of Mice and Men. down into the container again. I read this the other day, he said, reaching out to hand me a book titled The Laws of Human Nature. It's a great read, he said. It's a great read, he added. Unquestionably, he was right. It is becoming one of my favorites. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Laurent. Thank you very much. And Robert, why don't we start with you, please?
All right. Well, I thought that this was like a great storytelling by S. Sharp. You follow him every step of the way, like everything that he speaks, like from the beginning, and then it progresses and progresses and progresses, and it gets to this. It's almost like a short story, more than just a poem. I mean, it is a combination, I guess. But the morning freeze held me, bundled in coat and scarf, but he seemed oblivious to its presence. He was just there. He was used to it, you know. We jumped out of a container, our eyes locked, but soon he vaulted himself into another behind tattered books. Stop, I watched as he held the book after book in his hands. So what I pictured was, you know, he's coming across this guy, and he's trying to show his generosity, and it doesn't seem as though it's superficial, but the guy he doesn't need it because he has all he needs, you know, even though he doesn't have money or doesn't appear to have financial wealth, he has inner wealth. And a lot of people try to use that, say, hey man, at least, you know, you don't got money, but you got your health. And this guy really is the real deal when it comes to that, it seems. So I thought he made it a very interesting character. Two interesting characters, actually. They resound off of each other very well and really took his story ran with it. So I thought it was great.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Robert. Thank you very much. Pam, how about you?
Yeah, this is definitely a great write. I like that it's a Christmas poem, and yet it isn't, you know, because it's obviously from the title and the mention of the holidays, but it's one of those poems that you don't limit it to only reading it at Christmas time. Wonderful creation of these two characters and their interaction. I like his description of the man. Hunger popped from his face, sunken cheeks hidden by a scraggly, dirty gray beard, bony chest and arms wrapped in rags. I like how this really is a poem that imagery, a short story or poem where the imagery and metaphors really touch on the idea of don't judge a book by its cover. And, I like the books he mentioned. Well, I don't know the laws of human nature. It sounds like it would be a fascinating read, but Of Mice and Men is one of my absolute favorites. And I can tell you that even if this is in part or fully made up by Scott, there is truth in it, in the fact that a lot of books get thrown away. Like I used to actually work at a restore, which is basically like a Goodwill, but they sell a lot more like stuff for like what your house would need. It's ran by that organization that builds houses. Anyways, one of the things, we would get so many books in back that we would actually end up throwing a lot of them away. And I will tell you, some of them, well, they're not going to be lost or missed because they were nothing but cheesy romances. But it is very sad the amount of books that get thrown away and discarded when people can use them. An excellent write all the way through. And I do like those lines. He seemed at peace I thought, you know, that, you know, I think when somebody is at peace with their life and at peace with the idea that they have found a way to gain knowledge, that's a beautiful thing. And then the end lines. Unquestionably, he was right. It is becoming one of my favorites. What a wonderful first-person narrative and very well done.
Well said, Pam. Thank you very much. And Laurent, you got to read. How about you?
First, I have to say that Pam has this unerring habit of selecting exactly what I was going to select. So I have to quickly press added comment in the middle of her comment. So it shows that I wasn't copying from her. great comment, Pam, as well as Robert. He seemed at peace. I stood with the $20 still outstretched in my hand. I'm looking for nourishment of the mind right now. This is really a story for the season, and it was wonderfully realized. Mental food, which is gleaned from books, is true food. For if we disappoint the mind to satisfy the body, we just end up starving in the long run. This is a fascinating and very satisfying writing.
Excellent. Thank you. I think the bite in this was the very different paint with this coming across a homeless person rummaging in a dumpster. The idea of it not being a drugged out or a drunken individual, and the juxtaposed position of both the descriptive values of each one, him being sunken cheeks hidden by a straggly, dirty gray beard, bony chest and arms wrapped in rags, battered effortlessly into and out of dumpsters behind the mini mall. And then the thought of him being clad in a nice warm coat with a scarf. So you see the two differences between the both. But he's offering up $20 feeling sorry in the moment, yet the one who is rummaging offers up the note that, hey, I get what I need in food, and I don't take too much. He's rummaging for a little bit of wealth, as Laurent put it, feed the mind. So you see the disparate difference, and you note the fact that this guy's not really as bad off mentally, physically, or out of sorts, except he doesn't really have a home, and he's doing the diving to feed both ends of himself. And the idea of that note up top, a Christmas gift, despite him offering up to $20, the real gift is what he got in that moment. The thought of being given a book, The Laws of Human Nature, the great read, the guy added, and unquestionably he was right, it is becoming one of my favorites. The thought of noting the scene and giving birth to the idea of what happened in that scene, yet he couldn't give up, he couldn't manage to give the guy the $20 because he really didn't need it, because he had plenty of what he wanted. And the real gift was even him offering up a moment of charity. The real gift came in charity from this guy rummaging through the dumpster. And it was something of a learning experience that he can sit there and take and add to, wow, I thought I had it all, but maybe he has more than I have in the moment. So nicely done there, Scott. Thank you very much.
How many times, I've got to add, how many times have we pitied someone only to have them make us feel small by their example? Great piece.
Absolutely. Thank you, Laurent. All right, Pam, we're coming back up to you.
All righty. Well, up next we have Zeitgeist Zeppelin Zebras by Eric Svensson. And we have a SoundCloud for that, so here we go.
Zeitgeist Zeppelin Zebras. Beneath quirky quasars, we nebulae dream, heads asleep on round Sisyphean stones. Bedouin desert dwellers, we're compelled to traverse sky ladder runs, propelled by miraculous night sky copula, spurred on by auspicious comet trails, coyote, hyena, scarab, Joshua trees, nimble oryx, we're in for the long haul. We shun gravity's gravitas, Jacob's sky ladder runs our staircase. Lightning conductors, we're chips of the primordial poet block. Lockjaw quiet, we observe storms brew. Trust our uncorked viper sniper tongues to zap black holes with. Let there be light. Jacob's sky ladder rungs for us are hung, strung down like gill nets for us to catch dying fish. Thor's whiplash cracked stacks thunderclouds. Close-knit seronophilia comrades, we cluck-cluck chirp. Quirky frictions diction, our time clock ticket, oft stirred, never shaken martini makers of note. Zeitgeist zeppelin zebras, we trawl our gill nets over a world asleep. Oh, beloved Sisyphean souls, trade numbness nunneries for our oasis. Sit down on magic carpet kilims beneath date palms. Savor your sweetmeat souls as the storm intensifies. Solidify, clarify and specify. Born of water, your miraculous, malleable matrixes. Does lightning strike the same place twice? If needed, poetic diction's freeze frame friction will flicker bigger faster. Sweet serenity of Jacob's sky ladder runs. Dippity do, our gill nets scoop up stricken fishes. Immersed in sea water, we're ponderous, pedantic little seahorses. Passionate zeitgeist, zeppelin, zebra pilots. Beneath quirky quasars, we nebulae dream stream your ascension. Wide awake heads, hearts and hands, a-rolling your Sisyphean stones. Incumbents of love's caravan, with Barbara Dixon, we greet you too. Break away, follow where the birds of freedom fly. You need to give, you need to live. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Eric. Thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It is much appreciated. All right, Pam, we're going to start with you.
Okie dokie, Smitty. Well, as always, he's got just brilliant imagery and metaphors. I see he wrote to the prompt, a poet is a man who manages in a lifetime of standing out in thunderstorms to be struck by lightning 5 or 6 times. Really clever references here. I like the reference to the Sisyphean stones, the idea of that being that stone that Sisyphus pushes up the hill over and over again for eternity. That idea of trying to push out those perfect words over and over again. I also like the references to the Jacob's sky ladder rungs for us are hung, strung down like gill nets for us to catch dying fish. That idea, you know, it kind of speaks to me on the thought of, you know, that we should be reaching for the stars, but instead we're clawing around for dead fish. I thought Zygus Zeppelin Zebras was some of the best alliteration ever. I also, I think this one also, though he didn't put it, I feel like it also speaks on the same prompt that, that Lawrence wrote to, in the idea of that, you know, if you you become that place, if you, and because it speaks on the sky and it speaks on the earth and it speaks on pushing that stone over and over again, and it has some great biblical references like the Jacob's ladder and the Joshua tree, which is I believe to be one of the most oldest living trees around. I don't know, it just kind of speaks to me in the whole idea of learning to use our voice and to find those right words and to dream big. So excellent write and very well done.
Well said, Pam. Thank you. And Robert, how about you?
Yeah, Pam touched obviously on a lot of the points that I thought, but Jacob's Ladder reminded me of that it's kind of like the experimental lightning rod type thing. I think it conducts electricity or something, if I remember correctly. And how Pam was mentioning the Joshua trees. We have Joshua trees over here in the desert, and they're very, very rare in the world. They've only grown in very few places. So I don't know if that brings any light to it. What I got out of it was basically, he said, you know, basically in the spectacle of the universe type of thing, we're just constantly plagued by repetition and bad luck. You know, where he says, born of water, your miraculous, malleable matrices. And then it says, does lightning strike the same place twice if needed? Poetic diction, freeze frame, friction will flicker, bicker faster. And there's the other part. It says, immersed in seawater, we're ponderous, pedantic little seahorses. And, I'm trying to find the part where he was talking about, Jacob's sky ladder rungs, for us are hung, strung down like gill nets for us to catch dying fish, you know? So, he basically says we are the fishermen and the fish, and either way, it's all, you know, filled with bad luck and repetition. So I really enjoyed his delivery in this. It's almost like listening to literature teacher read to you, but with kind of after like taking a hit of something, in a good way. But I dig it.
Nice. Thank you, Robert. And Laurent, how about you?
Well, those are some mighty fine comments on this poem. There were three references, I think, to Sisyphean stones, you know, a foreshadowing of the endless repetition of that haunts so many of our lives, the use of the sky, the use of the universe as a backdrop is filled with fresh phrases, which I find very, very nice, and they've already all been quoted, the Jacob's Skyliner. I love Thor's whiplash crack, stacks thunder clouds, close-knit Cyrenophilia comrades, we cluck, cluck, chirp. He does break into alliteration a number of times very satisfyingly. Breakaway, follow where the birds of freedom fly. You need to give. You need to live. It's such a wonderful message. Break free of the Sisyphean stones. don't yield to them all the time. Great piece. He always writes great stuff. Like Liquid Mind Forever. He's at the top of his game.
Nice. Thank you, Laurent. There's a couple of things that really hold the Zeitgeist, Zeppelin, Zebras, kind of hits me with the idea that as poets, we're the referees that offer up those notes. And the idea he put in a lightning conductors, we're chips of the primordial poet block. Locked your quiet, we observe storms brew. So there's that idea of don't worry about the block in the moment. Trust your uncorked viper sniper tongues to zap black holes with let there be light, showing the reality of what is there. And the thwart with Jacob's ladder runs a number of ways. It's that bridge between heaven and earth as one angle, but it's also that angle of that descent into madness if you let things get to you. But there is also one more. Jacob's ladder was also a reference to acid or peyote, that sort of bending the mind in a trip that allows you to see further than what you're offering right now. Because he keeps coming back to that sort of the sky, Jacob's ladder itself, plus spores, whiplash cracks, stacks, thunderclouds, close-knit seronophilia, comrades, we cluck, cluck, chirp. The idea of seronophilia being the lover of thunder and lightning, that quick snap that rolls into the mind in the moment. Quirky frictions, diction, our time clock tickets, off-stirred, never shaken martini makers of note. Again, that thought to mentality and using it to voice that which you're offering up. And he keeps going on with little tidbits like that. The thought of the nunneries, a bite out of Shakespeare, get out of the nunneries instead of get yourself to a nunnery, so to speak. Don't sit in a realm where everyone else is. Look outside yourself and breathe and then offer up that voice in the moment. Then the thought of immersed in seawater where ponderous, pedantic little seahorses. Why be the ones trying to teach? Instead, offer up your passionate zeitgeist, Zeppelin, zebra pilots. The note of those who actually drive the voice, drive the angle of inquisitive thought. And you need to live. The back end of this is offering up that which comes to you in mentality and putting back into the note of thought throughout the world. So great piece, Eric. Nicely done. All right, Pam, we're coming back your way.
Well, I have to say that was a great comment, Rex. I like how you mentioned the idea of not forcing the words to come out, but rather letting the mind be open. So very cool. And up next, we have The Red Snow by Northern Powerhouse. And we have a recording for that one. So here we go.
The red snow. We didn't even notice all the snow that stirred the air. It must have soaked our gleeful faces in the city square as a stranger whisked me through the crowd and clasped me for support, and we danced our peasant reels in the parliamentary court. Our country free, the scorched debris of fervent revolution, our carefree dance, our newfound chance to cherish absolution. All through the masked, exultant night, the cheers and music surged, while underneath our senseless feet, the drifting flakes converged. You clutched me still so closely as our prince marked out the beat, and I never saw the carnage of the bodies in the streets. The cold embrace, our swirling pace, I came of age, reborn, and I was sure we would endure as we succumbed to dawn. Yet here I stand alone amidst the ruins of the city. To never know your name at all seems such a stab of pity. As thicker flurries turned our flag a strange, ironic white, and now I see the snow lies red in grave, unsettling sight. The flag unfurled, the brave new world that somehow stayed the same. The lover lost, the covered frost that hid our scarlet shame.
Wonderful read there, Northern Powerhouse. And thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And Laurent, why don't we start with you? What did you think of this?
I enjoyed it a great deal. The Northern Powerhouse, I'm wondering whether it isn't from Northern Ireland. And the battle that was fought there for their own independence. I have to admit, and I sound a little bit crazy here, I'm attaching a significance to the red snow and the covered frost that hit our scarlet shame. I don't know whether it's a shame at because it's the revolution failed is like a lover lost, or that there was actually a lover lost in there. I'm not sure. Perhaps you'll examine that point a little more closely. I really enjoyed the rhyming in this. All through the masked, exultant night, the cheers and music surged, while underneath our senseless feet, the drifting flakes converge. Any revolution is subject to its own ambitions, which may be way beyond the ability to deliver. I'm reminded of the Arabs in the movie The Lawrence of Arabia, when they finally managed to kick the Germans out, and all of a sudden they took back their land or wanted to, and they sat in conference, and the entire revolution crumbled to bits because they had no experience with running a society. They were nomads, essentially, and eventually their own revolution kind of dissipated like the wind blows the snow. And perhaps that's why it says, lies red and grave, the revolution has bled itself out. Great piece.
Nice. Thank you very much, Laurent. Pam, how about you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say that Northern Powerhouse, I don't know about anybody else, but he's new to me, and I really hope we get to see more of his writing for our shows. I thought this had powerful imagery, great rhyme. I liked that the rhyme wasn't forced, and it didn't cause a disruption in the storytelling. You know, just amazing imagery and metaphors. I like how he writes on the idea of a revolution and a violent revolution. And I like that there's not a specific time period that it seems to connect with or a place. So it can be very culturally relevant to any place or time. I really particularly like All Through the Mass, Excellent Night, the cheers and music surge, while underneath our senseless feet, the drifting plates converge. You clutch me still so closely as our prints marked out the beat, and I never saw the carnage of the body in the street. I really like how this speaks on the idea that oftentimes people who celebrate the revolutions of the world don't necessarily see the carnage of the revolutions of the world. So amazing, right, and very well done.
Oh, thank you, Pam. And Robert, how about you?
Well, I always like poems that started in an opposite spectrums, and he started it with like a feeling of celebration and glee and things, but it turns out that you think that that's the result of the revolution when actually it's the opposite, that the so-called revolution or re-evolution, however you want to say it, because I always thought of it that way, as a re-evolution, trying to remake something. But it turns out that he's just he was speaking from memory, like how things used to be, and now he's just sitting there in the aftermath of a vain war or battle of sorts. And you know, it's like all wars, it shows that it's meaningless, and there's nothing to show for it, really. You know, all it is just blood. That's all there is. There's just blood and death and despair. And he really articulates that well, even in his tone near the end of the poem. Like Pam said, I really enjoyed his reading. Like he has a really good reading cadence to him, and it just flowed so well. And like she said, it wasn't forced at all. And this one line flowed into the next, and each thought just mingled with the next. He did a great job in presenting it and reading it, and also the rhyme was awesome, and the content was gripping and poignant, and I thought he did a great job for the prompt, and it is very true even now. So yeah, great job. Northern Powerhouse.
Great comment, Robert. And I walked the very same lines you did. Those first two stanzas were born of those moments, the glee, the cheerfulness, the celebration. And I like the end lines he dropped in here because of the little extra punch he added to them. Our carefree dance, our newfound chance to cherish absolution. And then, and I was sure we would endure as we succumb to dawn. And then that third stanza offers up that note. Yet here I stand alone amidst the ruins of the city. To never know your name at all seems such a stab of pity. A stick of flurries turned our flag a strange, ironic white. And now I see the snow lines red and gray, unsettling sight. The flag unfurled, the brave new world that somehow stayed the same. The lover lost the covered cross that hid our scarlet shame. Reality is they celebrated a bit too soon. That third stanza offers up the breaking of dawn, only to find that they had given in the moment, and the shame came with all the death that surrounded them in the first place that he didn't take note of in the celebration. And the thought of the lover lost, the covered cross that hid a scarlet shame, the lover lost that idea of in freedom itself, being lost in the moment because nothing has changed. It's still the very same as they started out the evening before, and there's tragedy in that. Very well done there, Northern Powerhouse. A great read. Thank you very much. All right, Pam. We're coming back to you.
All right. Well, up next we have Art for Art's Sake by Weaver of Dreams, and we also have a recording for that. So here we go.
I care for you. You are my friend. But you insist on asking what I think of your art. Yes, I took a look, a long, hard look. I saw yellow paint with a black dot off-center. Did it invoke a reaction? Well, okay. I felt extremely nauseous, and the room was spinning. Of course, I didn't say that. I merely coughed, asked, more new work. My, you've been busy. I asked my sister's advice. She said, be blunt. I mean, it's ugly, but is it art?
Great read, Kate. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is much appreciated. And Laurent, why don't we start with you? What do you think?
Oh, Laurent had to go because he's falling asleep.
Okay, then it's you. Ha-ha.
I kind of figured. I liked this. This cracked me up. I mean, there's nothing like the dilemma of having to be honest with a friend about their artwork, about your thoughts on it. It also kind of made me think of when you're a parent of a young kid who brings a picture to you and they want you to guess what it is. And you're like, I have no clue. I think it's an animal of some kind. But like I said, this has a great straightforward style. I particularly liked, did it invoke a reaction? Well, okay. I felt extremely nauseous and the room was spinning, you know. And I asked my sister's advice. She said, be blunt. I mean, it's ugly, but is it art? I like the way she fit the chosen prompt in there at the end, but it fit in so seamlessly with the poem. So an excellent write on the idea of trying to get up the courage to give an honest opinion to a friend, and very well done.
Well said, Pam. Thank you. And Robert, how about you?
Yeah, Kate always cracks me up when she decides to add a little comedy to her piece. And it is a dilemma of sorts, like, you know, like there's just certain questions you don't ask if you don't want the answers to. A lot of people tend to try to deviate and, you know, be nice or whatever. But people like myself, well, I try to remain tactful, and I can understand the approach, but I really understand the ending. Like, I asked my sister's advice, be blunt. I mean, it's ugly, but is it art? Yeah, and that she did work it in there very well. Like, she put it in there, like as if it was, you know, like as if she came up with the quote herself almost. But yeah, like did it evoke a reaction? Yeah, I felt extremely nauseous and the room was spinning. It's like, yeah, so she was being totally honest. This is also a very relatable and humanistic piece too, in the sense that, I mean, we've all been there. Like someone asks us something that they don't want the answer to. And what do you do? And this is kind of like, you know, it really I can't think of the word, but it puts that on display, that ideal. And she did it so well, like so comedical. And yet it's a very well-structured poem as well. So I thought she did a great job with the prompt. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Robert. Yes, it is humorous, and it takes a bite at us, because we often ask, hey, what do you think? And be blunt. Yet the idea is we don't really want them to be blunt. We want them to be massage the mind, so to speak, so that we get a good feeling out of it. But you know what? Being blunt is a more even-handed way. You don't have to be mean or ugly about it, but offering up a thought to the angle of what you really think is, well, you know what? It's a little bit more honest instead of trying to hide behind the voice of, well, I'd say this. This one sounded good, but it doesn't really hit on the idea of when a friend asks you to be honest about it, and then you offer up dishonest. So she's taking a nice plug at ourselves, but I do like the back end of this. I mean, it's ugly, but is it that does conjure up a notation to the thought of what each individual considers art. You can look at a crass painting or crass poetry. People will consider it art, while a good many will offer it up as, God, that's sheer shit. Why do you insult us with it? But everything has its place, and everything has notations to people's interpretations. So, nicely done, Kate. Thank you very much. All right, Pam.
All right. Up next, we have Dinner Parties of the Damned, epilogue by Mind Shadow. And Robert, will you give that a read for us, please?
I will try. Just there, between beats of melodic nursery rhyme, terms of surrender, bullshit you render, frosted ugly by time, driving all day away just to get my ass tonight. Too many lefts, I wheel bereft, and fuck it twice, it's just not right. On ramp, tease, fast past jazz, interstate dares me to exceed. Buck 20 buzz, the fuzz, I was, and yes, I knew I did it, because she said, it as she so often does. Are you crazy? Yes, I was. She never seemed to grasp, though still claimed to have a perfect ass, that I hated her red shoes, wall bred headbangs, fucking zoo. Motive, I said motive. Then we went out way too fast, chasing fear in rearview mirror. Those days of perfect ass now pass. Saying true slick slithers nearer, maybe clearer, or not, I fear. She said, just get away from me. I'm doing a buck 65. You're doing that to spite me. Said perfect ass. Nope, just to survive. At some point between her screaming and calling Jesus on the phone, slammed into a 180. Backed that shit in. We were home. End poem.
Great read, Robert. Thank you very much. All right, Pam. What do you think?
Oh, I liked this one. Wonderful read there, Robert. It's great to see a poem by Mind Shadow. I'm glad he was inspired. Awesome inner and end rhyme. I like how this is about one of those just horribly dangerous, horribly wrong relationships. It made me think of the movie Natural Born Killers. With Woody Harrelson, and I like the reference to the perfect ass, driving all day away just to get my ass tonight, and she said it as she goes off, and yes, where is that meant? Oh, yeah, she never seemed to grasp, but still claimed to have a perfect ass, that I hated her red shoes, wall bread, handbags, fucking zoo motive. The idea that there's just so much to hate about this woman. And there's a lot of bike, strong imagery and metaphors. I like at the end where he decides that the perfect ass just, nope, it isn't worth it. It's more important that I mentally and physically survive. A great ending line. At some point between her screaming and calling Jesus on the phone, slammed into a 180, back that shit in, we were home. You know, it's funny because you go through all that crap only to be coming right back to where you were again. So excellent write and very well done.
Thank you, Pam. And Robert, you got three. What do you think?
Well, this is definitely one of the more provocative pieces. I had fun reading it. There was a lot of interesting word choices here. I also enjoyed the line that Pam put. Pam has a knack of doing it. like Lauren said, you know, she never seemed to grasp, though still claimed to have a perfect ass, but I hated her red shoes, wall, bread, handbags, fucking zoo, you know. Like how Pam said, is like she's just like such a terrible company. And, you know, it says the quote that he wrote to is, the people who live in a golden age usually go around complaining how yellow everything is, you know. So there's no pleasing this person, and this person is always seems to be like they're in the right, and they're just terrible, terrible person to be around, and yet they're still hanging out with them, but they end up back home, so who knows where it goes from there, I suppose. But yeah, I thought this was a roller coaster, if you want to say. He was doing a $165, is that what they say? Yeah, $165. So that's pretty guy, pretty damn fast, man. And then just do a 180 and back that shit in, and we're home. That was pretty wild, I have to say. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Mind Show.
I think the line "back that shit in" is a clue as to where the rest of the night is going to go.
Yep, because it starts with the title, "Dinner Parties of the Damned," which offers up a note to having to go to those parties you don't really want to go to, and you know where the evening's going to end up. And it all hits just there between beats and melodic nursery rhyme, turns to surrender, bullshit you render, frosted ugly by time, driving all the day away just to get my ass tonight. That note, everything's rolling in that metaphor of, God, will it ever end? And it's a husband and wife, because he rolls into that note of everything that's happening in the evening, yet you still got to drive to go home, so to speak. And backing that shit in, we were home, officer, oh, and will it ever end? Will she just go to sleep? Or do I have to keep putting up with the rambling of the notation with the drink that she has imbibed on that evening? It just said, he wants to get away, but can't get away because they live in this very same house and they've grown to hate each other.
Well said there, Rex. And awesome show tonight, Rex.
Absolutely. Great show. A lot of funny lights and a lot of deeper lights, too. Thank you, Rob, for dropping in on us and helping out. And Laurent for reading and commenting. And wonderful evening all the way around. So we'll do this again next Tuesday. So have a nice evening, everyone.